Okay, so good morning, everyone. So I've assembled a number of topics, so starting with some basic ideology in the beginning and then going to some concrete examples further on. But there's not much more structure than that to the talk, so don't hesitate to interrupt me at any time, and I can give more details. And of course, it would be nice if this led to a discussion amongst everyone here. This is more or less tutorial style, so this is not a research presentation. I've not taken great care to allocate credit, so this is by no means all my work. I'd nonetheless like to acknowledge the people who are my main collaborators in this field. Chronologically, that's John Chalker, Shivaji Sondi, Oleg Chernyshov, and Sergei Isakov. So, so the rough overview, why would one want to study frustrated magnets and what are they? Say a few things about classical frustration and about order by disorder, which is a concept which crops up quite a lot in this field, and there's some rather nice examples for how this happens. I'm going to say a few things about quantum frustration, again, what it means and some examples of that. Then I'm going to give a few materials examples and something about magnetoelastics, and that's more or less it. Okay, so why study frustrated magnets? So firstly, materials physics, because there are a lot of them, and some of them may even be useful, and I think several talks in this program have already really alluded to this fact. In addition, they're conceptually quite important model systems, which have the added advantage that they are frequently tractable. So they are model systems for strongly correlated problems. They provide a very natural way of greatly increasing fluctuations. Many systems with coupled degrees of freedom of particular interest in this workshop. There are a lot of interesting phases, in particular their new quantum liquids, and there are several unconventional phase transitions, and I've tried to put together an example of each of these in this presentation. So here's some history. So the first frustrated system by today's definition has been studied was by Linus Pauling just down the road in Caltech. This was 1935. And it was ice, so I'm going to say a few words about that. Then the 50s, there were two important papers. The first one, triangular easing magnet by Vanni and Hautapo. These are two different papers. And then pyrochlore easing magnet by Anderson, 1956. And there's a very beautiful paper in 1977 by Villain, where he coined the term cooperative paramagnet, which I'm going to explain again. There's a moderately complete biography by Oleg on his website. And then there's some reviews, so on low-dimensional quantum magnetism by Grégoire and Claire. You can find that on QuantMath. There's a book by Dieppe, which has been re-edited quite recently. Art Ramirez and I have written an article, very basic level in physics today, last February. And I think currently a new book's being edited by Frédéric Millat, which, if everyone keeps to the deadlines, should arrive soon. Okay, so things are moving so rapidly that even Oleg can't keep up. Okay, okay, so what are the hallmarks of frustration? So really, I think many people now think of frustrated systems as those which are largely degenerate. So so often, especially in like 10 or 15 years ago, a common definition was that you said, well, if there are some interactions which can't be simultaneously minimized, you have a frustrated system. So the best example for that is just three spins, three antiferromagnetically coupled easing spins in a triangle. So once two spins are happily anti-aligned, then the third spin no longer has a direction available which is opposite to both of the others. So you see that this thing either has to frustrate that bond or this one. So that's one possible definition. This is a bit bit problematic because often it's possible to rewrite a Hamiltonian so that really the problem's still frustrated, but you can minimize all terms in the Hamiltonian. So take, for example, four spin arranged symmetrically in a tetrahedron. You clearly see that it's not possible to make all bonds happy again, so in this case, this one and that one are frustrated. But you can certainly rewrite the Hamiltonian in the following way. You take the sum over all spins and you square it. So if you multiply out this sum squared, you get terms like sigma I squared, which is just a constant, which you can drop. And then you get terms like 2 sigma I sigma j, which give you that. But this is a perfect square. You can certainly find states which have the total spin equal to zero. This one, for example. So you can minimize every term in this Hamiltonian, but you clearly still have a degenerate ground state. So in this particular case, you have six ground states for easing spins, because out of four spins in the tetrahedron, you have to choose two which point down. And this degeneracy is really the, I think, defining feature of what we might call frustrated models. So frustration leads to degeneracy, and in easing systems, very neatly to a zero-point entropy. So let's just come back to the previous slide. So general Hamiltonian, basically, you have a unit like a triangle or tetrahedron, and the total spin has to be minimized. So for a triangle, there are basically six such states, either two spins point up and one spin points down, or vice versa. And this triangular easing magnet can be solved exactly, and the ground state entropy has been evaluated. There's an easy way of seeing how this happens. So just have a look at this ground state. So you see that there's some spins like this one which experience no net exchange field, because it's got the same number of neighbors pointing down as it has of neighbors pointing up. So you can flip the spin at zero cost and energy, but you can also separately see that each of these triangles is in fact in a ground state. There are always two spins pointing up and one spin pointing down for each triangle. So you can flip the spin, but it turns out you can't just flip this spin. You can flip lots of other spins as well. Independently, you can flip this one, this one, this one, this one. Totally independently, because flipping this spin doesn't change the exchange field on any of the neighboring flippable spins. So you see that a third of the spins of this lattice can be independently flipped. So this gives you immediately a lower bound of the entropy of log 2 per flippable spin, and one third of the spins are flippable. So this is obviously lower than that. But nonetheless, this tells you roughly how the zero-point entropy comes along from the degeneracy. And the thing that's important are that these degrees of freedom are local, so there's an extensive number of them. And this is, again, something which is rather typical of these frustrated magnets. So and then one question which arises very naturally is what happens at low temperatures. So obviously, at high temperature, a frustrated magnet isn't that much unlike an unfrustrated magnet, because one paramagnetic phase is very much like another. But degenerate systems are very different at low temperatures. Sorry. So to display this, I've displayed here two plots of density of states, A of an unfrustrated magnet and B of a frustrated magnet. So an unfrustrated magnet, you can just think of, say, a ferromagnet. So that's called order one ground states. So of an easing and a ferromagnet, all spins pointing up, all spins pointing down. Then you can flip a single spin. Basically, if there are n spins, there are n first excited state, you can flip pairs of spins, or then you can flip spins independently and so on. This is roughly what the density of states looks like as a function of energy. For a frustrated magnet, this is somewhat different. So just to get, you can't even plot these on the same scale, because I told you that there were exponentially many states, even ground state for a frustrated magnet. So even if you plot the logarithm of the density of states, there's still a peak of height n here, even in the ground state. So really, there are questions in statistical mechanics you can ask about these frustrated magnets, which simply don't have a counterpart for unfrustrated magnets. For example, what is the statistical mechanics of the ensemble of ground states of a frustrated magnet? So for a ferromagnet, that's easy. For a frustrated magnet, this is quite a non-trivial problem, and it varies a lot depending on the system you're looking at. So in particular, ground states can exhibit rather subtle correlations, and if I get that far, I'll give you an example of that towards the end of the talk. And that's one thing, but just the question, what are the properties of this ensemble of ground states? But then there's, beyond this, a very rich question you can ask, namely, what happens when you perturb this kind of system? So imagine you sit at a temperature which is much lower than the spacing between the lower ground state and the first excited state. Then you have an ensemble of states, all of which have the same energy. So if you now add a perturbation to the system, you no longer have a small parameter to perturb in. You have to do degenerate perturbation theory in this extensively large manifold of ground states. So all perturbations are strong. In particular, that means that you can then have many instabilities, basically depending on what perturbation you have. There's no reason for one type of quantum perturbation to give you the same ground state as that of than that which you get using another perturbation. And so This is at the origin of the fact that you get very rich behavior in these systems. Basically, there are many ways of perturbing. There are many ways of perturbing and many ways of selecting a particular linear combination of these ground states as your full ground state. And so this is true both in theory, where you can easily think of walking through parameter space, through Hamiltonian space, but also in experiment, because again, for a particular compound, there's no reason for the terms which are beyond this ideal simplified Hamiltonian to be the same in different systems. This is also the reason why this problem is rather hard. I mean, it's non-perturbative, so you don't have a small parameter. And in more than one dimension, often you're really short of ways of treating this in a controlled way. And so if you remember the discussion on, say, Kagome spin a half, this is a very elementary problem. But nonetheless, we really don't know what's going on there, because we don't have any controlled analytical treatments, and all the numerics is cut off at rather short, small system sizes. So just, of course, one thing this is supposed to remind you of is quantum Hall physics, where you get a very similar density of states diagram. And of course, the reason quantum Hall physics is so spectacularly rich is very similar. OK, so this was the ideological introduction. I haven't had any very hostile comments yet, unlike most of the other speakers so far. So let me now say a few things about. Different regimes in these magnets. As I told you before, at very high temperatures, the paramagnetic phase for a frustrated magnet is very similar to that of an unfrustrated magnet. So you wouldn't be able to tell these systems apart. But if you now go to lower temperatures, you notice something rather strange happening. So this is what you might call the susceptibility fingerprint of frustrated systems in experiment. So if you have an insulating spin system, at high temperatures, its susceptibility follows a Curie-Weiss law, which basically means the inverse susceptibility is a straight line. The straight line extrapolates to cross the x-axis at a particular temperature, the Curie-Weiss temperature, and mean field theory tells you that you should have a phase transition which, in sufficiently high dimension for unfrustrated systems, actually occurs around the Curie-Weiss temperature. But actually, so basically the Curie-Weiss temperature tells you what the scale is of the interaction, the energy scale is of the interactions in your system, and you therefore expect some transition to happen at a temperature which is order one times the Curie-Weiss temperature. But actually, in a frustrated magnet, you don't see anything happening that is at all spectacular as you go through the Curie-Weiss temperature, and you can go a very, very long way below that temperature until something happens. What happens depends on the system you're looking at. So this comes back to the idea that this is a very rich field. So it may be freezing, it may be ordering, it may be distortions, a lot of different things. But in this regime in between, this is something that is common to many of these frustrated magnetic compounds. You're sitting at a temperature where the interactions are very strong, but the correlations nonetheless appear to be rather weak, and there's no ordering.
But change
yes, because I did it using Xfig, but I mean, so the statement is that there's no non-analyticity anywhere, right? I'll show you an actual plot of actual numerical data in a second, which.
See the same thing, for instance, for weakly coupled two-dimensional antiferromagnets.
Sorry.
If you have weakly coupled, like a high-density superconductor.
Okay, so this is only half the story. The other half is if you looked at heat capacity, for example, I'm not sure whether I'm going to discuss that later. So you see that the amount of entropy which is left after, so you see a Schottky anomaly around Curie-Weiss temperature, and the amount of entropy which is left once you go through that is quite different between the two of them. So in the frustrated setting, you have a lot of entropy left below that. In the unfrustrated setting, you don't. So the amount of degrees of freedom which are actually involved in disordering you for low-dimensional reasons is much less than which are involved in frustrated magnets. But this is a perfectly valid point. Yeah.
If you examine a two-dimensional system on a short length scale, it's ordered. Right? Whereas a frustrated system remains on a short length scale.
I understand
say fingerprint, right? So fingerprint means a one-to-one
okay.
identification.
Well, this is an interesting question in legal profession at the moment. But as I say, this is only half the story. But whether or not something is low dimension, yeah, okay. Low dimensionality is another way of destroying order, but it's not so hard to tell them apart. Okay, and so really, so the two questions I treated a second ago, this what is the properties of the ensemble of ground states and what are the, you know, what are the rich instabilities that you find really get reflected here in the cooperative paramagnetic phase, which is sort of something more generic, and then a non-generic ordered ordered regime. Okay, so let me just tell you how you might develop a simple theory, a similar theory like the one I told you a second ago about the entropy for continuous degrees of freedom. Of course, the distinction between discrete and continuous degrees of freedom.
Can I go back to the comment?
Okay.
Suppose you had a 2D, strictly 2D square lattice antiferromagnetic.
Right.
So it never orders, but still the, you know, the uniform susceptibility goes to constant. As temperature goes to zero. So it's not going to have this kind of behavior, right? I mean, there will be a qualitative change, presumably at the Curie-Weiss temperature there, where it basically flattens out. So it doesn't look different. It has a fairly drastic change of behavior at the Curie-Weiss temperature. A little bit of 3D coupling was only changing things at much lower temperature. But, it doesn't look like this, at least.
But a little bit of 3D coupling actually will order the system close to Curie-Weiss temperature again, because, you know.
Depends how little.
Well, as long as it's not exponentially little. Yeah. And, right.
In Cuprey, there is still a factor 10 to
200
Kelvin ordering 2000 Kelvin.
I mean, just as a point of principle, strictly 2D system doesn't order, it's not frustrating. It doesn't look like that. It's different.
Okay. So the distinction between continuous and discrete spins is something that's, of course, much more easily done in. This is a discussion. You don't have to apologize.
No, but experimentally, I think it's very easy if your samples are somewhat conductive. Yeah? It's very easy to mistake, say, I don't know. Power is stability or whatever, complex parametrism for the
Right. So I'm not presenting a theory of everything here, and I did at least slip in the statement that I was talking about insulating magnets. What I'm trying to do here is give you a guide of what these magnets typically look like. As I said, there's a huge variety and a lot of the interest in the field stems from the fact that there's not one theory to cover it all. But
theory. It's just that many people are sometimes unduly optimistic about frustration here. The sample is better.
What about the amplitude if you do that? Is there, if you say have a localized spin of order, a few Bohr magnetons, would you? I mean, you mentioned if it's weakly conducting, wouldn't there be an offset in the size of that contribution?
I don't know. You have different electrons, electrons that are responsible for conducting.
Differently colored, okay. All right, so.
Pauli, is constant at low temperature, right?
Yeah. So you see, curve like this, flattening
out,
to zero.
Yeah, sure.
Also, fun play might somehow simulate that.
Okay. So for continuous, I'll skip the sentence, which has won me three interruptions so far. So you can. So for continuous spins, you can similarly try to say how big ground states are. And I found this rather useful exercise. So you can basically say, we're taking the same Hamiltonian, the nearest neighbor Hamiltonian, total spin squared. So that means you can think of sort of a single triangle or a tetrahedron. Then you can couple these together. And the way you can determine how big a ground state is, this is, again, not rigorous, but often rather accurate, you can say, well, we can count constraints, so we can say, how many degrees of freedom do we have? That's rather easy if you know what kind of spin you have, so this is F. Then you can ask, how many constraints does this Hamiltonian impose? So how many conditions do you have to satisfy to be in the ground state? And then you basically take the difference between those two, and that gives you an estimate of how big your ground state degeneracy is. So for the case, for example, of the pyroclore lattice, which has come up on several occasions already, so here you can see the following thing. So you've got, per tetrahedron, you've got two spins, because they're four spins, and each spin is shared between two tetrahedra. For Heisenberg spin, each spin has got 2 degrees of freedom because it lives on the surface of a sphere. Number of degrees of freedom. Then for each tetrahedron, you've got 3 constraints. The x, y, and z component of the total spins have to vanish. So the number of degrees of freedom in the ground state is 1. Per tetrahedron. So this is an example where you, a quarter of all the degrees of freedom that you start off with remain unconstrained even when you cool the system to zero temperature. So just to give you a little bit more detail on this, so if you just think of isolated units of Heisenberg spin, so you think of a pair or spins in a triangle or spins in a tetrahedron. So if you have 2 spins, you have an unfrustrated system. So 1 spin points up and the other 1 spin points down, and there are no internal degrees of freedom left. Similarly, for a triangle, unlike in the easing case, there's a unique way up to global symmetry operations of getting total spin equal to 0. This is where these 120-degree structures come from. But for a tetrahedron, it's different. If you've got 4 spins, you in fact have 2 degrees of freedom left. So just take 4 spins in a way that they form a closed loop. So the 2 degrees of freedom are A, so this angle alpha, which opens the parallelogram, and then the angle phi, which rotates 2 spins out of the plane. So for a single tetrahedron, there are 2 degrees of freedom. It turns out when you combine them, one of these survives. And in this particular case, you can actually give a proper proof that the number of degrees of freedom is at least 1 per tetrahedron. So again, this is something which is very different from most other magnets you know. There are not very many magnetic systems which have such a huge ground state degeneracy. And I think Oleg has called the pyroclore magnet the world's most frustrated magnet. And I'm not sure whether people agree, but basically here are some particularly frustrated magnetic lattices. So here's the pyroclore lattice. If you project the pyroclore lattice along a 1-0-0 direction, you're left with a square lattice with crossings, which shares many of its properties, even though it's got a lower symmetry. Here's the Kagame lattice, which people here know very well. Then there's a system known as either the pyroclore slab or a Kagame bilayer, which is SCGO. So if you have a Kagame lattice here and a Kagame lattice there, and you join them by an intermediate triangular lattice, you see that you get locally something which looks like a pyroclore lattice because you've got a tetrahedron here and a tetrahedron there, which share corners, just like here. So in fact, if you take a 1-0-1-1-1 slice like this of the pyroclore lattice, you get this system. And from what I've just said, actually, a Kagame layer and a pyroclore slab would actually behave rather differently, and certainly in a classical setting, they do behave very differently. This is gadolinium, gallium, garnet. Okay, so let's take a first look at the thermodynamics of these systems. So just show you how short, that if you look at some quantities, you can really treat these systems as being pretty much as if they had a correlation length of only 1. So this is what I call the single unit approximation. So I've written the Hamiltonian so far always in terms of the total spin of a tetrahedron, which I call L here. And I'd just like to do the following exercise. So just think of taking a single tetrahedron and solving that exactly. Classically, that's, well, both classically and quantum mechanically, that's very easy. So L is the total spin S. So you know 2 limits very simply. So one is at low temperatures by equipartition, the total spin goes the square of the temperature because the Hamiltonian is the spin squared. And at high temperatures, the total spin goes to 0. So you solve this, and then you compare it to simulations for a pyroclore lattice. And so for the energy, here I've plotted the theoretical curve in light blue and the simulations in the circles here, and you see that the energy course, agrees extremely well between what just a single tetrahedron does and what the full pyrochlore lattice does. So this would lead you to think that, in some sense, the correlations here are really extremely weak. And you can do the same thing with the susceptibility. So here I've just shown you the Curie-Weiss law. Then you can see from either the Monte Carlo data or the or this simple approximation that the deviation between those is rather small. So around the Curie temperature, the deviation really is tiny, and then nothing particularly spectacular happens down to the lowest temperatures. All right, you see that the error here is in fact a little bit bigger because the energy basically only depends on nearest neighbor correlations, whereas susceptibility also has some contributions to further neighbor correlations. So this is something that should suggest that the pyrochlore magnet really is extremely paramagnetic, even though that turns out not to be the full story. Okay, but this is one example, one simple theory which more or less reproduces a specimen curve of the susceptibility fingerprint, which really doesn't have any particular features at any temperature. But there is a clear deviation from a Curie-Weiss behavior. Okay, so next, how are we doing for time? Sorry. All right. Next, I'm going to introduce one concept known as order by disorder, which is very fundamental. People differ on how deep a concept this is. So Schender told me once that realizing that order by disorder is happening is something as trivial as noticing that you're speaking prose, because he said, what else can happen? But anyway, I'm going to tell you a little bit in a, again, simple setting what order by disorder does. So the basic idea is that fluctuations lift degeneracies. So imagine you've got a large number of ground states, all of which have the same energy, U. But you know, at finite temperature, the thing that you want to minimize is not the internal energy, it's actually the internal, the free energy. And so the free energy has not just the internal energy, which is the same for all the states, but also a contribution to the due to the entropy, which is weighted with a temperature factor. And the idea now is that if these different states differ in their entropy, even though they may have the same internal energy, one of them will be selected over the others in the limit of low temperatures. Even in the limit of low temperatures, so think of Heisenberg spins, because in Ising spins you really have a gap to low energy fluctuations, but classically Heisenberg spins can fluctuate an infinitesimal amount, so these fluctuations will take place at any temperature. So the basic picture that I'd like you to have in mind is that if you have configuration space, sort of this is a very high dimensional space, which I've drawn as two dimensional here, then you've got a ground state manifold, which is a subspace of this full configuration space, so here a one-dimensional one. And then at low temperatures, you can draw all the states which have an energy less than a certain energy which is proportional to temperature, which is, again, this blue region here. Now, there are two different qualitative settings. So one setting is when, basically, for any given ground state, the area which you can fluctuate in a transverse direction is more or less the same. So there wouldn't be any preference for this ground state over that ground state over that ground state. So the average over all the ground state is more or less just an average over this black curve with an appropriate measure. But something rather different can happen, and often does happen in these systems, which is that there are some particular states in which fluctuations are really very soft, and then you can explore a huge region of states near the ground state for some particular configuration, but not for others. So this is I've drawn in a cartoon here. So basically now what happens if in the limit of zero temperature, the area here near one particular ordered state is much bigger than the area combined for all the other ordered states, then you're actually going to probe the correlations of this state rather than the full ground state manifold. How can that happen? So for the case of a single tetrahedron, again, there's a very simple way of seeing that. So you have so I've told you the total energy for a single tetrahedron is just L squared, which is the total spin squared. So that's got three components, Lx squared, Ly squared, plus Lz squared. But here you see if the spins happen to be collinear, there are some fluctuations which actually do not cost any energy to quadratic order. Say this one, if this spin fluctuates a certain distance in one direction and the other spin fluctuates a certain distance in the other direction, then the total spin in the, in the two transverse directions remains zero because these things cancel, but in that direction, along the spins, it's only second order in eta because it's transverse to the original direction of the spin. The fluctuation is transverse to the original direction of the spin, and cosine eta is proportional to eta squared. So then L squared is proportional to eta to the fourth, and that means that there are some particular soft fluctuations, and rather than being able, just by equipartition, to have eta squared to be order temperature, as is normally the case for quadratic modes, here eta to the fourth has to be proportional to temperature. In other words, eta can fluctuate all the way up to the fourth root of temperature, and if the temperature goes to zero, the fourth root of temperature is much bigger than the square root of temperature. So you can, in this picture, imagine that most states have can fluctuate a region which is the square root of temperature, and this particular one can fluctuate to a much bigger distance. So you have to calculate the trade-off between sort of the configurational entropy of those states and the fluctuational entropy out of the ground state manifold of that state. And it turns out, for XY spins, in fact, you do get this collinear selection, whereas for Heisenberg spins, you don't, because for Heisenberg spins, the configurational entropy around here still manages to overwhelm the fluctuations out of the collinear state. Anyway, so this is an example of order by disorder, where some particular soft fluctuations select a particular ground state. And I think this is something that happens extremely often in model systems, even though I continue not to be convinced that there are any experimental systems where a thermal order by disorder effect has been unequivocally identified as driving ordering. But in theoretical model systems, it really happens all the time. The main problem is, there's a lot of ordering at low temperatures which may or may not be due to thermal fluctuations. You normally have to exclude that it's not due to some other phenomenon. So if you find collinear ordering, you have to make sure that it's actually due to thermal fluctuations and not because you've got some pathetically small single ion anisotropy. So, they do have different signatures. The stiffness depends on temperature in a different way for order by disorder than for say quantum order by disorder. Some BCC type structures and body center type structures tend to be the best candidates, but I haven't seen one which I'm actually convinced by so far. There's one which has been claimed, erbium titanate, I think, but again, so that I think published in Physical Review some while ago, but again, I wasn't convinced by it.
You mentioned only thermal fluctuations, but in quantum systems, you can have quantum fluctuations at zero temperature.
Right, I'll come to that in a second. The reason I mentioned thermal fluctuations is because there's really no question of what to call the leading term and what to call the fluctuation term. The temperature is not part of the Hamiltonian the same way that quantum fluctuations are. So if you have quantum order by disorder, I agree there are many examples of that. I'm aware that you've contributed to some of that yourself. And that does play an important role. I just thought that this is really the cleanest setting for explaining what order by disorder is, and then I'm going to come to some other examples. In like all sorts of biosystems, this stuff is really common, and hard spheres and God knows what. Yeah. I was talking about magnets, so there are lots and lots in soft condensed matter, lots and lots of systems where this clearly happens. A lot of the interactions in soft condensed matter are entropic at the end of the day, like excluded volume type effects. Okay, so here we go, quantum frustration.
Is there any theoretical understanding of why the Heisenberg one doesn't order?
We have a constraint counting theory which basically tells you what the different volumina do. And then if you compare them, it turns out the Heisenberg magnet is the only one of sort of the natural lattices which sit, where the configurational entropy is big enough to kill the fluctuational entropy. All the others don't. So the way this basically works is that you, in the limit of low temperatures, you estimate the volume of configuration space which is available to these special states, and you compare it to the volume of configuration space which is available to the generic states. And you just see whether the power of temperature and the limit of low temperatures is higher for one or the other. Like for all the ones we know, like Kagome, it's always the special states which win. For pyrochlore, it's exactly balanced. So you can certainly write down models simply where this thing clearly goes in one direction. So if you have these models of the corner-sharing octahedra that you've looked at, so there the balance is clearly in favor of the non-order by disorder, but the smaller the units get. So basically, you have to pay D, and you get a number of soft modes back, and D needs to be less than the number of soft modes, or less. Okay, so quantum order by disorder. So as I just indicated, this is used to describe many very different situations. And the simplest case I'd like to present here is to go back to the triangular lattice, where we now say we have one leading term, which is the exchange term, so you have these exponentially many ground states, and remember there were these flippable spins and so on. And then think of these things being able to fluctuate due to the application of, say, a transverse field, for example. So a transverse field so is the most local quantum dynamics you can think of because it just flips a single spin. So the Hilbert space of our restricted model is spanned by the classical discrete ground states, and the quantum dynamics is now given by a transverse field. So what does the transverse field want to do? Well, in the simplest picture, the transverse field wants to take a given spin and point it in the x direction. So this is written in the z basis, so a spin pointing in the x direction in the z basis simply means a spin which points up and down in a coherent superposition. So how can you get spins to point up and down in a coherent superposition? Well, the simplest way of doing that is to have a spin which can point either up or down classically without being constrained by the exchange. So these are precisely these flippable spins I introduced in an earlier transparency. So in other words, if you have a flippable spin, you can point it either up or down. So the transverse field puts it into a linear combination of the spin pointing up and the spin pointing down at the same time. And what you'd like to do now is maximize the number of these flippable spins. And the way, so you have this motif basically of a hexagon with a flippable spin in the middle. You'd like to maximize this, maximize its occurrence. The way you maximize an occurrence is basically a tiling problem. You want to tile as closely as possible these hexagons. As you know, if you want to tile something closely, usually you end up with a crystalline state, and in particular, this is what happens here. So in this state, which maximizes the number of these flippable spins, you find that these flippable spins form one of the three sublattices of the triangular lattice. Then there's an up sublattice, which is the second sublattice, and there's a down sublattice, which is the third sublattice. So here, in order to maximize the ability of the system to fluctuate, you've ended up ordering the triangular easing magnet, because in order to maximize the fluctuations, it takes away you take away some of the configurational again, some of the different possible states that you started off with. So this is, again, in a nutshell, how quantum order by disorder works. Just in order to allow the system to fluctuate, you actually reduce some of the freedom. You pay some of the freedom that you had initially in order to allow the system to fluctuate more. So these kind of pictures appear in very many different cases. So if you remember Philippe's tutorial on the Kagome magnet, there he had a number of possible solid states suggested. So the arguments leading to those solid states are essentially these arguments. They're just more complicated if you have more complicated types of quantum dynamics. But all these states were argued, well, certainly the one by Nikolic and Sentel and the one by Maleyev, I think, basically argued on on lines such as this. But these kind of models appear in lots of other places. So, for example, in super solids, they've played a role in ring exchange models and so on. There's some, and again, order by disorder is something that happens almost all the time. You have to work rather hard for it not to happen. So one particular case where it doesn't happen is in the Kagome easing antiferromagnet transverse field. There turns out that the phase diagram looks like the following. So if you have temperature and transverse field, it's a paramagnet everywhere. So it's perhaps the simplest quantum magnetic phase diagram that you can think of. But this is something that you have to work very hard to achieve. So about strange phase transitions. So of course, this is not going to surprise anyone in here. But starting with an easing magnet, you can now ask, if you have an ordered state, what is the nature of the phase transition that brings you to this ordered state? And it turns out, if you work out that particular phase diagram, it looks like that. So here you have a 3D Coslet-Salis phase transition. You've got a Coslet-Salis phase, a paramagnet, and then there's this ordered phase, three sublattice. And naively, it comes as a bit of a surprise that you start with an easing magnet, you end up with an XY magnet, but this is actually XY transition, but this is actually rather easy to understand. So the minimum, which corresponds to this wave vector, which corresponds to this modulation, is a root 3 by root 3 wave vector. So we call that, say, Q, and this has got an amplitude 5Q, but then there's another amplitude 5 minus Q, because it's no longer at the corner, because it's no longer at the center of the Brillouin zone. So these amplitudes have they have an amplitude and a phase, but in order to get a real spin configuration, one has to be the complex conjugate of the other. So you really have one complex amplitude to construct your Landau theory with, and if you have a complex amplitude, you immediately get led to an XY type transition. The reason it's 3D is simply because it's 2 plus 1 dimensional at zero temperature. But this is the simplest example I know, where you start with an easing magnet and you end up with phase transition of different universality class. And one, again, reason.
Are there no terms in the Landau theory which are allowed to actually break the XY symmetry?
So this is why you have this guy. This is why you have the three sublattice ordered state. So if you come at zero temperature, you get a 3D transition, but this six-order clock term becomes relevant immediately. So this is why you immediately go into the ordered three sublattice state. You do the same thing at finite temperature. You have this Cardanoff, Jose, and whatever phase diagram for the two-dimensional model, where it takes a while until the clock term becomes relevant, and then you order.
So basically, we have these six
anisotropy
of our U1 model.
That's right. So it's a six-state clock model at the end of the day. And so just starting from a simple easing anti-ferromagnet with a transverse field, you get a phase diagram which is a lot richer than that of the Kagame magnet anyway, with a floating Coslet-Salis phase transition. So this is an example how you can start with very simple models and end up with rather rich behavior. Okay, thanks. Okay, so we've discussed that quite a lot already, so let me just skip that. Okay, so a few things about materials, which people here are very interested in. So if you just take what Takagi calls the simple spinel oxides, I've just made a list here, where you, so the B side is a pyrochlore lattice, and the A side you can basically tune, put different ions, different ligands on the A side, which then give you different nominal valences. So one of the nice things here is that you can write a big table just by changing the different compounds. You can get nominal valences, which may be half integer or integer, and you get really pretty spectacular behavior. So you can get everything from a superconductor to a valence bond solid to structural phase transitions to charge order. So a lot of people who are present here actually spend a lot of their time worrying about explaining sort of the individual behavior of each of these. So, for example, one thing I'm going to talk about in a second is zinc chromide, but one thing that several people here will, I'm sure, be quite interested in is heavy fermions, lithium vanadate, because that's got a lot of multiplets. So certainly different type of ordering instabilities that you might expect in some charge ordering, since it's got non-integer valence. It's got orbital degrees of freedom. It's highly frustrated. It's a highly frustrated magnet. Upon some substitution of one of these, you get a spin glass. And then it's also a poor conductor. So there's really a lot to be understood. And I think perhaps if you ask Oleg nicely, he may give you a tutorial on that sometime later in the workshop.
Is the pairing symmetry known for that?
I think it's with a large error bar. I think it's S wave, but I'm not sure.
Otherwise, we'd hear about it.
Okay, so I'd like to take the chromium spinels as the simplest example, where you get not just the magnetic degrees of freedom, but some other degree of freedom coupled in. In this case, since it's a half-filled D-shell. You have still have isotropic spins, but now you have lattice degrees of freedom. So it's isotropic spin 3/2 in a pyroclore lattice, and then you can ask, well, we now have elastic degrees of freedom which interact with a frustrated magnetic system, so how does that happen? So the simplest starting point for that is you take a Hamiltonian, which corresponds to a magnetic part of the Hamiltonian, an elastic part of the Hamiltonian, and a coupling between the two. So the magnetic one is something you've already heard about a lot in this talk. The elastic one is just the standard sort of harmonic oscillators. The magnetoelastic one has got the following form. So the simplest ansatz, if you change the length of a bond, the exchange of this bond, exchange constant of this bond is changed in a linear fashion, so you're Taylor expanding, and then the energy contribution is determined by what the spins along this bond actually do. So then you can ask, what if I add this coupling dj by dx, if I set this not equal to zero, how does the magnetic frustrated degenerate system react? So let me just tell you some boring outcomes. So if you have an unfrustrated system, then Si dot Sj certainly classically can be uniform. And so in the simplest case, you just take dj by dx to be some number. Only depends on what happens for the x along that bond. And if you have a uniform chain, basically, the magnetoelastic term, basically, I mean, you have to minimize something like that. So you first put the, So if you can extremize these terms separately, then you know you found the minimum of each of them is separately in a minimum. So the magnetic term you can minimize by an simple state where all the spins are anti-aligned. And then you can ask, how does the elastic degree of freedom respond? Well, basically what happens is that since there's an energy to be gained by strengthening each bond, but all the bonds have the same both stiffness and the same magnetic energy, what happens is that the system simply uniformly contracts, and you gain some energy, but nothing happens to the magnetic state. So basically the minimal energy, you just notice that there's some magnetostriction, and that's it. It's uniform. This can be very different for a frustrated magnet, and the basic difference is that you start with a degenerate ground state. So these degenerate ground states are in general not symmetry equivalent, so that means that the Si dot Sj term can be non-uniform. So now the system actually has a choice to make. It can choose to strengthen the unfrustrated bonds and weaken the frustrated bonds, because the frustrated bonds cost you energy. If you weaken it, at the end of the day, you gain magnetic energy, whereas the opposite happens for an unfrustrated bond. So the energy balance is that the magnetic energy, you get a linear gain because as I dot Sj is not equal to zero, and as x appears linearly here, it's the first term in a Taylor expansion, but the elastic energy, there's a quadratic cost in x because you were sitting in a minimum to start with. So basically, what you find, and if you do the calculation properly, you find that x is going to be proportional to Si dot Sj, so if it's positive, it's one sign, if it's negative, it's the other sign. So if you integrate out the phonons, you end up with an effective biquadratic exchange. So you'd expect that this kind of physics will favor collinear states. So in a nutshell, why does it favor collinear states? Well, in collinear states, the difference, the non-uniformity of Si dot Sj is maximal. Either it's plus one or it's minus one. So you can gain a lot of energy by strengthening the minus one bonds, and you can gain a lot of energy by weakening the plus one bonds. So you generically expect that since this gain is linear and this cost is quadratic, that you would always distort and that you would generically find collinear states.
I mean, the coefficient of your biquadratic exchange is always negative. Otherwise, that wouldn't be the case.
You can cook up.
If you minimize, lower the energies.
It's going to be negative. It probably is because you do Gaussian integrals.
I
mean, the fact that it's not always seen suggests there's some subtleties here, which I haven't really thought through. But I mean, maybe the interactions between the phonons or.
That's right. I'm basically taking an extremely simple model for the phonons here.
The interactions are not present, but like, are they in linear materials. Anisotrop- bond-dependent anisotropies, which make the spins not
collinear. Even without that, if this is assuming you have independent displacements
right.
in each bond, if you don't do that, you do get sure. still biquadratic terms, but involving
right.
spins on different sites.
So the innocent K I've written here really is something that you know depends on the bonds and.
Yeah, that is not just collinear.
Right.
But even models with Heisenberg magnets and more complicated phonons don't necessarily give you collinear
yeah.
states.
Yeah, you might not find a collinear state that's in sync with these phonons.
Right. That's
they
right.
They don't necessarily form Bell-Mont crystals.
They mostly don't.
Is it obvious why it should be commensurate things?
We don't.
No. In fact, experiments.
Well, that's just the
right. No, but okay, yeah. I mean.
Well, there are very many phonons here, so it's hard to predict what's going to happen.
If they want to be parallel, they probably want to be commensurate. Yeah. They want to be commensurate.
Well, you have to be a bit careful. If you take a simple Q equals zero structure, then typically, it's commensurate and it manages to optimize this. But even within that, if you take a single tetrahedron and you try to tile it, you may not be able to do that. I think that's something that Leon has done with these magnetization plateaus, which are on the next slide. So here you can, for example, go into a system in a field where instead of having total spin zero, you have a total spin which allows for three spins to point up and one spin to point down. Again, very similar analysis tells you that you would expect a biquadratic exchange. So this would then favor basically these collinear states, and this is actually stable for a finite range of fields. The simple reason that you can gain a lot of elastic energy like that. So when I did this slide, I said details to be worked out. So I think Leon has since done a theory basically trying to make a more realistic models of the phonons than the one I've just talked about, which had an extremely simple approach. And there you can even try to predict what the exact ordered state is, because there's still a lot of three up and one down states which can appear. But so this is an example where you sort of have what might be called order by distortion. The system distorts, and as a result, you get a stable collinear ordered phase. Okay, you have to tell me to stop, by the way, because there's, I've still got a few things, but I don't want to tax people's patience too much. Okay. So let me just perhaps take as the final topic all this things which, at least until perhaps recently, were fashionable under the name of emergence. So here the question is, so I've already given you an example where you start with easing spins, you end up with an XY degree of freedom. Are there more exotic ways of achieving something like this? And so in particular, one thing you can get is that you start with easing spins, you end up with a gauge theory at low temperatures. And I'd just like to say how that happens. So start again with a pyrochlore lattice. For those who were at my talk on Tuesday, this may look sort of familiar. Think of the pyrochlore lattice as a diamond lattice, and the spins now live on the links of the diamond lattice, and now think of the spins as pointing either one way or another along the diamond lattice bonds. And then say that on each, so that's all you need to take away from this slide. And then I'm going to argue that if you define an easing magnet for this, actually you find a low energy theory, which is very different from the theory that you started with. Okay, so as I said, so the spins now live on these links, and they basically define a vector field living on the links of the lattice, which we call BI. And now if we say that, as I said before, you have two spins pointing up and two spins pointing down, in this case that translates into two spins pointing in and two spins pointing out, you basically see that this ground state constraint can be rewritten as a local constraint. Namely, if you write down the lattice divergence of this field, you find that the constraint that two spins point in and two spins point out is the same as demanding that the lattice divergence of this field be zero. And this is something that's locally has to be the case. So at each of these diamond lattice sites, you have to have a lattice divergence which is equal to zero. So the reason, and very briefly, that you end up with a gauge theory is that you know how to resolve this, B is curl A. And then if you've managed to formulate your theory in terms of A, then you basically have ended up with a gauge theory. So this is one thing. So you have a local conservation law. This is sometimes the case, but not always. I would like to emphasize that. So these easing pyroclore magnets are one particular example. Then you can ask what happens to the degeneracy in terms of these arrows. So it turns out you can't, unlike in the triangular easing magnet, you can never actually flip single spins, because you see, if you flip this spin, and there were two in and two out here initially and there, if you flip this one, then you get one in and three out, which is clearly forbidden. In order to heal this, you have to take another spin which points out, and you have to reverse it, but then this side is unhappy, so you have to reverse this one, and so on until you form a closed loop. So in fact, the only way you can go from one ground set to another one is that you take a loop of spins, all of which point one way, and you reverse that. And the shortest loop you can do that with in the pyroclore lattice is this hexagonal loop of length 6. Okay, so this is going to be important in what follows, but here's an example where this sort of gauge constraint stops you from having point-like excitations, but you can still have point-like flips in the ground state, but you can still have local flips like this. So where's the difficulty in treating these kind of problems? So this is now a simple classical problem. You want to average over all the I states. But the problem is that you've got this local constraint. At each side, you want to have two spins to point in and two spins to point out. If you now want to go to an effective theory, you'd like to integrate out short wavelength degrees of freedom to get an effective long wavelength theory. But here, basically, a lot of the physics just takes place at the short distances. So if you say at each side you want two spins to point in and two spins to point out, that's not the same as saying for 100 sides you want to have 200 spins pointing in and 200 spins pointing out. If you coarse grain like that, you simply end up with some microcanonical description of a paramagnet. So somehow you need to pick a degree of freedom which incorporates this constraint even upon coarse graining. And this is the point of you starting with a divergence-free field. If you say you start with a divergence-free field, you then coarse grain, but you make sure that the field remains divergence-free, you're actually keeping track of this lattice-based physics. So you now coarse grain from this lattice B to a coarse grain B, which still has the divergence of B tilde equal to zero. Then what happens upon coarse graining? Well, just come back to this little picture I had here of this flippable loop. You see that if you've got a flippable loop, the average of B over this loop is zero, because basically this arrow is opposite to that, this is opposite to that, and this is opposite to that. So as you coarse grain, this coarse grains to zero, but this also coarse grains to B tilde equal to zero. So you see that if you've got a low average flux, you've got many microstates. So this motivates an ansatz where you say that you get an energy function of entropic origin. So initially you just start with a microscopic B, you say, for at each side you have a divergence-free B, then you end up with a coarse-grained B where you still have the divergence-free condition, but in addition, you favor states which locally have a weak average B tilde because they correspond to many of the initial states. So the nice thing about this particular action is that you know how to solve it. It's just a quadratic problem. So skipping a few steps, you can now work out the spin correlations, and the spin correlations have this structure that you're used to from artificial magnetostatics. Basically, the correlators are transverse. What this means in Q space, if you look at the structure factor, you expect motifs like this, where you have this bow tie structure, where you have a non-analytic point here in the center, then you've got a high intensity going one way and a low intensity going the other way.
There that you're relaxing the constraint actually, and that gives you an energy function.
So I'm taking, I'm not relaxing the constraint, that's still in here, but the point is that when I coarse grain, I basically take several microstates and they get all mapped onto the same coarse grain state. And what these microstates have in common, the lower their average field is, the more of them get mapped onto the same coarse grain state. And so this is the term which remembers that.
Was B integer on the lattice scale? Is that?
Yeah, it was. Also.
That's really what, I mean, the coarse graining B becomes a continuous variable.
That's right, yeah.
It becomes a Gaussian theory.
That's right, yeah.
What's the difference between critical and algebraic?
So critical means that you would like to have some relevant operator sitting around somewhere, and algebraic just means it's... okay, so this is a very important question. Algebraic just means it's got a power law behavior. So normally we use these terms interchangeably, but in fact, I mean, we have all sorts of power laws appearing in, you know, Maxwell electrodynamics, but no one thinks that we're actually sitting at a critical point, and if someone tunes one parameter a little bit, if the speed of light we measure by 1% wrong, the system is not going to crystallize all of a sudden. And this is the same thing here. Okay. Oops. Okay, so old measurement on the structure factor of ice. So ice has got the same effective theory. So admittedly, it's not obvious where the bow ties are, but I'll give you a hint. You have to look at the center of higher Brillouin zones, and these you find by looking at the nuclear Bragg peaks. So this is basically the proton distribution in water ice, which is described by the same theory, and you see that you appear to find more of these bow ties than you would expect from a totally random assembly. Okay, so this is an example of one of these emergent gauge theories. So ice turns out...
Is the diamond lattice ice?
This is this is IH. This is just normal ice. So sample preparation is you go out to a lake in winter and cut something. Yeah. Okay. So as the last slide, I'd just like to say that you can now give a quantum dynamics to that in this way, which is very similar to this transverse field easing model I described to you earlier. So you take a Hilbert space, which are the classical ice or spin ice configuration, and there were these most local way of changing from one allowed state to another, and you simply add in your model a coherent quantum dynamics for this hexagonal loop. And then you use the Horrocks-Akillerson trick, which I'm not going to explain, which gives you a model which you can actually solve at some point. The important thing is you go through all the same treatment that I had a second ago, and you get an effective long wavelength theory, which is just Maxwell electrodynamics. So you certainly know what one phase of this looks like. And this is more or less a phase where you have free electromagnetic field, and you know what the excitations there look like. These are gapless photons. These are transverse excitations. And it turns out you can actually tune the speed of light here. The speed of light near this point, V equal to T, is actually proportional to V minus T. There are several remarkable features about this. So, for one thing, this gives you deconfined quasi-particles. For those who heard my talk on Tuesday, I went into that in some detail. Another thing that's really nice is that this is a very simple microscopic model. It just contains one exchange term and then this quantum model as a perturbation on top of that, and it gives you an effective U1 gauge theory with deconfinement in a very simple microscopic model. So it's very easy to get these as effective models. Basically, the way you do this is you write down this effective model, but it's not so common to get these as directly from a microscopic model. So a few final words, again, about the idea of emergence. So one thing that's remarkable here is that you end up with photonic excitations artificially, so there's not any electrodynamics as such in here. The electrodynamical degrees of freedom are just degrees of freedom of the spin system. So these photons really have to be interpreted in terms of spins moving around in a coherent fashion. So if you, for example, look at the speed of light, I would say, well, it's nothing special that we've got a tunable speed of light. The way we do this normally in the lab is we take a dielectric and then that changes the speed of light. What's different here is that if you take the dielectric away, you're still left with photons in vacuo. But here, if you take the ice away, you're left with nothing because the ice really acts as an ether for this artificial electrodynamics. So this is really a cooperative effect. And if you were sitting inside this ice crystal with these photons sitting around, you were scattering these photons off one another. Unlike in our world where we appear to find for sufficiently high energies something like, say, electron-positron pair production, here you would rather discover some other of the quasi-particles or even lattice degrees of freedom. So this is an example, I think a particular simple and nice one, where you start off from some degrees of freedom at high energies and you find totally different and interesting degrees of freedom at low energies.
Previously, D squared term was entropic and now it became energy.
Well, the question is what these constants mean. I've dropped a lot of constants. But so there's some stiffness, and there's a constant in front of this and a constant in front of that, which you can try to determine.
It's generated by quantum fluctuations.
Sorry?
It's generated by the quantum fluctuations.
Let's see. So this is self-dual. So So one of them is the quantum dynamics, and the other one, yeah. So if you switch off the quantum fluctuations, you're left with what we had originally. Okay, so let me just summarize. So the first part of the talk was frustration leads to degeneracy, which in turn leads to strong fluctuations. And that is a recipe for getting lots of new types of behavior, new phases, new phase transitions, interesting dynamics. I've showed you a few simple model systems, and there are lots of realizations which people are exploring at the moment. Thanks for your attention. Okay. Well, I mean, I've given you a very simple example for how new phase transitions can, unusual phase transitions can appear, but yeah, there's a lot of interest in these, say deconfined quantum critical ones, but that would take me a lot further. Again, there are people in the audience who are perfectly qualified to talk about this, so if you just bug them enough, they'll also give you a talk. Well, I mean, so we just had one of these. So there's a lot of materials which we simply don't understand at this point, right?
There are lots of small questions.
Right.
And a lot of theoretical predictions without.
That's right, without corroboration, and a lot of experiments without, you know, theoretical. So I mean, if you take one of the earliest one, the Kagame antiferromagnet, is still, as far as I can see, a completely open question. I mean, this being condensed matter physics, it's rather rare to find the one big overarching question, such as, why is TC so high?
Or low?
That's right. But, you know, here the proof of the cake is very much in the eating. So as you go along, you tend to find a lot of interesting and surprising phenomena, the interest of which is in large part given by the fact that you can then make contact with the experiment.
One question is, you know, this quantum spin liquids, which you touched on at the end, is there any in experiment? That's
yeah, for instance, yeah.
There are some candidates, but probably all of them have some.
Yeah.
Conceptually, you know, there were just an enormous number of open questions, particularly the two-dimensional spin liquids can. We know in model systems can they exist, but we have the issue of to what extent, you know, can you find them in various experiments, and that may or may not be so promising. But and the two-dimensional spin liquids, we know they, you know, they just sort of these two classes, topological and the critical ones, and the critical phases, you know, much, much more complicated than and intricate than this electrodynamics. And, you know, not more understood. And
Well, there's certainly also a lot of questions even beyond this, just what happens when you dope these things? What are the possible phases when you wet this with mobile degrees of freedom? And, I mean, as you know from the high TC problem, this is a rather robust question. But yeah.
You know, for classical systems, there are questions of critical phenomena, some critical exponents that are on lots of first-order phase transitions for no apparent reason. So
So these fall into this setting of, you know, this is traditional condensed matter physics with new phenomena in a new setting. And then there's the question, what can you get along lines like this? You know, again, how would you even begin to classify the new types of behavior, say, phases without local order parameters, but nonetheless distinct from high temperature paramagnetic phases? What are they? Where do they occur? Okay, the quick answer is I don't know, but the somewhat more lengthy answer is that in a lot of what one does in a lot of these systems is really find a representation of, say, a strong coupling expansion of one of these theories. So you know, these loop soups are often okay.
The Yang-Mills, you know, the non-abelian gauge theory, and three plus one dimensions are, at least unless you have a lot of gapless fermionic fields, are confining. And so you would, in the context of the kind of model like this, you would end up in, let's say, a valence bond crystal or some, you know, more ordered state. only in a algebraic phase.
So perhaps one other point to make here is that if you ask questions motivated, say, from high energy physics, what you find is that things which are believed to be true in high energy physics are actually no longer true here, because some assumptions which are natural in high energy physics, such as Lorentz invariants, don't have to hold in condensed matter physics, because imaginary time simply is very different from spatial directions. So, for example, you can get deconfinement in 2 plus 1 dimensional U1 gauge theories, which you wouldn't have expected based on, say, Polyakov's work, but simply because you're living in a different sector of the gauge theory.
Again. Generate
well, if you've got, I guess if you've got a Z equals 1 theory, you can get a theory which looks Lorentz invariant. I mean, so this E squared plus C squared B squared action I had, right, that looks... Okay, so we know a lot less about these. I mean, as you know from your own work, there are tremendously important open questions there, and I think the technology that has been developed to obtain the results I've been talking about here simply doesn't work particularly well. So again, there are a few people here who've spent a lot of time on doping these kind of models, and but I think we are nowhere near saying anything particularly systematic about this.
You mentioned Harry Thurman's in the concept of your talk. Is there any connection of you can see between
Harry Thurman physics? Well, that's very much so. What I try to emphasize there is that if you just say, well, heavy fermions, so the zeroth level of say, heavy fermions have a lot of entropy still sloshing around the system at low temperatures. In these systems, you certainly see that there are lots of potential sources for lots of entropy. Like these degenerate spin states, there's orbital physics, there's charge physics. So I think there, one question you can ask, is this a run-of-the-mill heavy fermion which just happens to have the possibility of having strange spin states, or is it actually different? And again, I think that's an open question.
There are some experimental materials where connection between frustration of various kinds and empirical observation of heavy fermion behavior has been suggested. Like this LIV-204 example was, at least Takagi wants to suggest that there's some connection between charge frustration and that observed heavy fermion behavior.
It's not obvious that it happens. There are not that many fermions there.
It's
interesting, and it's...
And there's some other material.
There's praseodymium iridate, for example, where the words condo appear in the title of the paper.
Is it understood then what kind of frustration you need to lead to this kind of behavior? Because since it's not commonly seen.
To lead to which behavior?
Probably
ununderstood. No. Really.
But there are just some big thoughts on that. It's not the right theories. Heavy fermion behavior from frustration.
Mm-hmm. I mean, once you dope, I think next to nothing is understood. I mean, wouldn't you say that at zero temperature you have Nernst theorem? I mean, you got rid of entropy anyway by some interaction with which you did not take into account in your model. So isn't it really a question about some intermediate temperature?
So this is in part what I try to motivate using this cooperative paramagnetic phase. In a sense, you can think of the Nernst theorem asserting itself at this freezing temperature. So no matter how perfect you think your sample is, something happens, right? But nonetheless, zero temperature calculation for the unperturbed model may tell you something rather useful for an actual observable range of temperatures in experiment. Yeah.
It's also a question of how many million years you have prepared to wait.
They're also dynamical degrees of freedom. Yeah, sure. I mean, if the system simply freezes, you're no longer able to define a temperature lower than that. So,
But then it's really a finite temperature question.
Well, everything we do is at finite temperature. And I don't think I've ever seen an experiment which is at zero temperature. Right. Yeah. People study quantum phase transitions even though no one causes a system to zero temperature. Yes, that's what I was saying. There may be... So one of the questions is, are there states which are distinct from high-temperature paramagnetic states which are nonetheless disordered by normal standards? And so topological phases, which I haven't touched on in any detail here, can have finite-temperature phase transitions between a disordered phase and another disordered phase. So, I mean, there's certainly cases where you can identify in a very crisp way that you've got two different phases. And besides that, in some cases, you have to argue about crossover phenomena.
Anyone else? Is there some question or comment?
Yeah, maybe a comment. Hmm? Order by disorder, you said there is no system. It's true there will always be residual interaction if you go to low enough temperature, you have some ordering. But it seems to me that you can detect it indirectly. Maybe this is related to what you plot there on the blackboard. Mm. But if your order by disorder selects not one state, but for instance two states, you might have an Ising transition at high temperature that would be really driven by thermal fluctuation.
Right.
At a certain temperature, you choose to develop fluctuations in two or several states. And then at lower temperature, the ordering will always have some quantum aspect to it.
So how would you distinguish that from from the same Ising order being generated by some residual anisotropy, for example?
There would be an ordering at low temperature that is and all the phase transition if your system is coupled. I mean, this might have been observed in one system in Scandinavian mode system 4, which is a J1, J2 model. Mm. The problem is we don't have a good characterization of the first order phase transition. It seems to me the Ising transition that will take place where you start developing, choosing one direction for fluctuations, is really ordered by disorder thermal. And then at lower temperature, you have an ordering of the system.
Okay, but I agree, but just the sequence of the phase transitions wouldn't tell you that. You'd have to say something about, say, for example, how the stiffness sets in and how that changes with temperature, because the Landau theory wouldn't tell you what the mechanism of the order is, but that would also generally give you this kind of sequence of transitions.
So what would be then for you a criterion for really observing
order? Well, so there are some predictions such as how the order parameter scales with temperature at low temperatures. It's different between order by disorder and thermal order by disorder and quantum order by disorder. That's just because one comes from a term in the free energy, which is proportional to temperature, so you get more powers of temperature there.
I mean, unless one really knows the Hamiltonian, is it really? Do you ever tell whether you have order by disorder as opposed to weak interactions?
I think the way, say, order parameter scales at low temperatures would tell you that.
But you are stuck in some intermediate regime. It's too low compared to the order by disorder temperature.
Right. That's high compared to
some other. Scale where other interactions
are just
lucky, but yeah, there are various things.
Probably a question is this order by disorder can be described by some Hamiltonian, German Hamiltonian actually, forces this order in here, and that might be different, say, from the isotropy of the area. And then you can, by applying magnetic field, this is the difference or something.
I mean, if you have an entropy, so I agree the term would look different in Hamiltonian because one would, the temperature again enters in a different way. But how would you tell a biquadratic exchange? But besides this, how would you tell a biquadratic exchange due to
biquadratic exchange is isotropic, yeah. So I
No, but you could.
Order would still work, yeah. So if I.
Right. If you have actual biquadratic exchange, say, from a larger loop in the Hubbard, higher order perturbation calculation, the Hubbard model, it would look the same. I agree, but this would be a way of telling an anisotropy. That's absolutely correct. This would be a way of telling an anisotropy from order by disorder thermal. Yeah.
I mean, roughly more qualitatively the thing which is weird about order by disorder, since it's driven by entropy, it's kind of strongest near the transition temperature where it happens, and it gets weaker as you lower the temperature. So that's, you want signatures of that, even over some intermediate temperature range. Sort of like these funny dependence of the order parameter, funny powers and thermodynamic quantities.
No, no, the order parameter isn't, but if you have an additional term present, you know, it's re-entrance. So, so if you had a small anisotropy which wants to do something else, it would happen, and then it would be killed by this anisotropy,
Or for instance, stiffness can be behaving in the opposite direction.
Right.
It's not monotonic.
Yeah.
You can go up in the
depth. It'll start going down as you go through this little
temperature. But the order parameter in the cases I've seen actually, and if you do simulation, saturates at one, so you get perfect ordering.
Stiffness is better than
that's right, but if you
could go down, is there
it could, but it's a little trickier.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thanks.